Dream. It was an evil dream. Go away. Go away, evil dream.
You're listening to the Dare Daniel Podcast, aka the Scare Daniel Podcast, where you send us your most sinister, scary horror movie dares, and we suffer the consequences for your amusement. I'm Corky McDonald, and you know what, Dan? I want you to stick it right up your brain. Just stick it right up your little, small, dumb brain. And with me, as always, is the film critic who I wanted to stick it up his brain, Daniel Barnes.
It's up there. Trust me, it's up there. Hi, everyone. On this show, we do your dirty work by watching the most unwatchable movies you can imagine, and then we review and rate them using our unique and very scary system. Run-of-the-mill bad film, we rate a dare, double dare to the truly atrocious movies, and we reserve the reverse dare rating for a despised movie that we think is actually pretty good.
Today on the podcast, we're reviewing Larry Cohen's 1982 monster movie, Q, The Winged Serpent. We're also going to read some movie dares sent in by our listeners, but before we get started, we're going to talk a little bit about the beers we're drinking.
Well, I once again have a Fieldwork beer from right here in Sacramento. Of course, they're based in Berkeley, but they have locations all over Northern California, including Seattle. Sacramento, I should say. I am having the Cafe Latte, K-A-F-F-E Latte Espresso Milk Stout. It's an ale brewed with espresso beans and milk sugar at 5.8% by volume. It is absolutely delicious. It is roasty. It tastes like coffee. It has this lovely milk sugar finish, so it's very, very gentle on the palate. It is a lot of flavor for a beer that is less than 6% alcohol by volume.
That sounds very sweet. Sounds like one of the things you would get if you trick-or-treated at a brewery.
Absolutely. This is coffee candy right here. And Fieldwork, for people in Sacramento, just so you know, Fieldwork delivers now. This beer and Fieldwork pizza was delivered. Yeah, Fieldwork has pizza. That was delivered to my door this afternoon by one of the Fieldwork employees. Thank you so much, guys. So I got beer, I got pizza, I got a Caesar salad, and it was all fantastic. Corky, what do you got?
I'm drinking an F Cancer. This is a 6% India Pale Ale. It's probably one of the better pale ales I've ever had. This one is from Silver Moon Brewing. Do you know where they're from?
I have no idea. I've never heard of Silver
Moon. Bend, Oregon. That's where they're from.
We love Bend, Oregon.
We do love Bend, Oregon. And I just want to say F Cancer. And for me, it says, what does F mean to you? F means fuck cancer. Fuck cancer. Shout out to my father-in-law, Hank Brow, going in for surgery tomorrow to remove a cancerous tumor. And we support all cancer survivors, all cancer fighters. Chip in, get yourself some F Cancer to help out.
Absolutely. Great beer, great cause. So, Corky, let's revisit last time we met. We reviewed a little picture called 365 Days.
Yikes.
Any additional thoughts that you have on that film or any of the other films that we've reviewed recently?
Not so much thoughts, just guilt. Just guilt for watching that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I mentioned during the film that my favorite part was where they go into Massimo and Laura, the woman that he has kidnapped to fall in love with him. They go into his bedroom and there is a portrait of Massimo with a lion's head, and he's like petting the lion's head or something like that. And it's like in his bedroom over his bed. It's like the tackiest fucking thing. You're like, oh wow, a touch of realism in this movie. Like, of course, the Sicilian mobster would have the tackiest, most fucking monstrously egotistical painting you could imagine. But what it made me think of was Alex Rodriguez. About like 10 years ago, there came out this rumor that Alex Rodriguez, in his luxury apartment in New York, when he was, you know, still playing for the New York Yankees, had multiple paintings of himself as a centaur in his apartment, including a gigantic one over his bed. I just like, wow. I mean, it's some that connection to me, it came through later on. The other thing that I wanted to say was, although we did bring back one of our most beloved recurring characters, Giuseppe,
Yeah.
The stereotypical Italian film critic and the longtime fan. I'm talking the longtime fans of the show know that Giuseppe originated on our World War II era radio program, Dan and Corky's Ethnic Comedy Showcase.
Yes.
Which was, I mean, it killed. It absolutely killed. it's funny when you think about the history of this show, the long and tortured history of the show.
Do you remember the zine? Remember the zine we put out in the 90s?
Right. And our time in the 19th century as a frontier traveling circus.
With the
Some of this stuff just seems like made up, honestly. It's sure. So weird. It's so crazy. The long and winding road, Corky, that we've been on. Mm-hmm. But anyway, yeah, I made the connection between Massimo and Giuseppe, and Giuseppe had some harsh words for Massimo, some very harsh
words.
Yeah,
he did.
But the one thing that I did not, I really kicked myself later, was that I did not, in the voice of Boris from Beyond the Seventh Doors, at any point during any of the copious sex scenes in the film, yell out, "The holes, Laura! Tell me about the holes!" So I'm just kicking myself over that. So that's you know, my high standards for myself.
You would have to do Laura's voice back. I don't know. They're long. There's lots.
Two more than most people have. It's not right.
That just hit me.
So now let's read some of the dares that our listeners have been sending us to us. They send them to us on the website. They send it to us on the Schmied. That is our term for social media. It shortens it, therefore saving time. People are freed up. They have tons of time because now they say Schmied. Instead of social media, it's a time-saving device. In fact, actually, the word Schmied, one of our great listeners, Ryan L. Terry, actually went on the Urban Dictionary and added Schmied to the Urban Dictionary. It's a word that we made up. He gave us credit for coming up with the word. What I thought was interesting is that in my spelling of it, my own personal, in my notes, I spell it S-C-H-M-E-E-D. Ryan Terry spelled it S-C-H-M-E-D-E. So, I mean, whichever one is fine, and that's all good. Although, interestingly, the latter version, S-C-H-M-E-E-D-E, Schmied, has already a definition, which means a hooked or even candy cane-shaped penis. So either definition works for me, but for you, you might want to clarify. So anyway, but thank you, Ryan L. Terry, for putting that on there and spreading the Schmied. Spreading the Schmied throughout the Schmiedoverse. We do have a dare, though, from one of our other listeners. Corky, do you want to read our dare?
Yeah, this dare came to us from Colin Williams, good friend of the show. His movie dare.
Friend of the show. Enough. Friend of the show, Colin Williams. I want to point that out. You didn't point it out.
I did.
No, you didn't emphasize it in the way that I did. You made friend of the show seem almost like it was a afterthought. To me, it was
You're right.
My buddy, your friend.
Bestest friend of the showest, Colin Williams, dared us Friends with Kids.
More friends.
A 2011 movie written and directed by Jennifer Westfeldt, starring Westfeldt herself, Adam Scott, Maya Rudolph, Kristen Wiig, Chris O'Dowd, and John Hamm. The IMDb synopsis for Friends with Kids. Two best friends decide to have a child together while keeping their relationship platonic so they can avoid the toll kids take on a romantic relationship. Why did Colin the guy who would take his shirt off his back for the show. I mean, would if the show needed $3,000, say, for, you know, to get car repairs or something, Colin would give him $5,000 just to buy a new car altogether.
Wow. I mean, this is
best
a real
friend
one.
Of the show.
We had a real one here, folks.
Why did Colin Darris Friends with Kids? Friends with Kids seemed like a movie that my wife and I, parents of three little kids, could relate to. Apparently, we missed the memo that having kids was supposed to turn us into bitter husks of the people we once were.
Apparently.
This film is rom-com trash that mistakenly thinks it's so much more clever than other entries in its genre.
Yeah, and the actual tagline for the movie is, I mean, he nailed it on the head. The tagline, when you look at the poster, Love, Happiness, Kids, Pick Two. Can't have all three. Sorry, yikes. Colin Williams and your wife. Like, what the fuck is that? You fucking... have you seen this movie? Friends with Kids from 2011.
Looking at the cast, it seems like it's just one of those things where they all got together, set up a camera, and thought, we're just going to be funny. We're just going to be charming together.
feels like a movie where it was like, get your buddies to be in this movie for me. You know, can you do that? I have seen the movie. It is putrid. It's awful. So good job, Colin Williams and family. Your beautiful family where love is all over the place. You have all of it. Love, happiness, kids. Don't pick two. Pick all three. Pick four. I have a fourth. A free one on me.
And now a feature program.
Q, the Winged Serpent. You heard the title song. It's different. That means it's October. That means it's Scare Daniel. We're watching scary movies. Horror movies, if you will. Our first entry into Scare Daniel is Q, the Winged Serpent. Dear to us by longtime buddy of the show, pal of the podcast, Hall of Fame head, Heather Smith. Why did Heather dare us Q, the Winged Serpent? I'm back with another amazing cinema masterpiece. Deep down, I really have a love for trash cinema, so I'm daring you to watch Q, the Winged Serpent. It's great for its amazing 1982 special effects. You have a ghastly creature that chomps people like gummy bears, David Carradine, motherfucking Shaft, and yes, a boob or two. I recommend you have some drugs, lots of drugs, before watching this movie. Look, it's not the worst way to spend an hour and a half. The IMDb synopsis for Q, the Winged Serpent? NYPD detectives Shepard and Powell are working on a bizarre case of a ritualistic Aztec murder. Meanwhile, something big is attacking people of New York, and only greedy small-time crook Jimmy Quinn knows where its lair is.
Yes, this week's film is Q, colon, the Winged Serpent, or sometimes Dash, the Winged Serpent. I think it's either way. It was written and directed by Larry Cohen. Some of his films included Black Caesar, Hell Up in Harlem, the It's Alive films, and of course today's movies, Q. He was also a prolific screenwriter. Q stars Michael Moriarty, Candy Clark, Richard Roundtree, aka Shaft, and David Carradine, who we of course know best from his iconic role as Sweeney in Think Big, starring the Barbarian Brothers. Can we do the Sweeney bit?
Let's do the Sweeney bit.
Try to get it on time this time. We're going to say Sweeney at the exact same time. Okay, you ready?
Yes.
One, two, three. Sweeney!
Sweeney!
Ah, Sweeney. 58 takes, and that was the best one. Unbelievable.
Sweeney!
Sweeney, keep doing it. Q, I should add, in the aftermath of Think Big, which, of course, as everyone who follows the show, this I'm completely going off topic here, but people who follow the show know that I love to do very awful impressions of the people in the film. You earlier heard me do my Boris from Beyond the Seventh Door. My impression of the Barbarian Brothers, I have just morphed that into my impression of television chef Michael Simon. Because we were watching Michael Simon's show Beer Barbecue and whatever, Burgers Barbecue and Beer, whatever. So
chicken bone every time
just becomes
chicken breast every time. Michael Simon.
I don't know what that's nothing. Anyway, Q is, of course, short for Quetzalcoatl. An Aztec monster god. Film was shot on location in New York City, and it shows. I mean, that's one of the really cool aspects of this movie, and it makes really prominent use of the Chrysler Building, including the spire of the Chrysler Building. Movie has a 69 on Rotten Tomatoes, which is somewhat misleading because most of those reviews are from modern critics who are looking back at this as sort of like, you know, campy or trashy or something like that. It was pretty dismissed in its day. Audience score of 42. It was released in the theaters on October 29, 1982. Budget of $1.1 million. It only grossed $255,000. Film critic Roger Ebert's original review opens with this story, almost certainly apocryphal. Quote, a few days after Q was screened at the Cannes Film Festival, the following conversation took place between Samuel Z. Arkoff, the film's producer, and Rex Reed, the critic. Reed, Sam, I just saw The Winged Serpent. What a surprise, all that dreck, and right in the middle of it, a great method performance by Michael Moriarty. Arkoff, the dreck was my idea. I say apocryphal because there's a few elements of that story that beggar belief. Hard to believe Rex Reed actually went and watched Q. If he had watched Q, it's impossible to believe that he actually stayed awake for it. And if he did stay awake for it, it's completely impossible that he gave a shit about any method performance because he is the biggest fucking oldest biddy and he always fucking has been.
Or that Samuel Z. Arkoff was at con.
Or that any of this ever fucking happened. I was just like, yeah, not so sure. Quirky. Quirky, you old Quetzalcoatl, you.
Yes, sir.
You old Aztec feathered serpent, you. This film, the Dreck, is it Dreck or is it not Dreck?
It's often said that jazz is about the notes that you don't play. Q, the Winged Serpent, is a film about the scenes they don't show you, about the information that isn't given to you, and about the performances that aren't there.
Mm-hmm.
There's plenty of Dreck in this movie, but I'm more in the positive side of the ledger on this.
As am I. Yeah, the real thing that stands out for a lot of people from this movie, and it stood out in this, as we said, probably complete bullshit story that Roger Ebert tells about Rex Reed and Sam Markoff, is that Michael Moriarty's performance is the thing that really is like...
Absolutely.
It's just strange. Like, it's really strange. Like, this movie, in many respects, is basically, it's an old-fashioned kaiju movie. It's a B-monster movie. But the twist is this kind of New Hollywood sort of a thing. It's not a lantern-jawed hero. It's not a sexy scientist. It's not anyone who is like your standard monster movie hero. This guy is a true anti-hero. He is a complete piece of shit. He possesses few, if any, redeeming qualities at all. The movie was also shot, as a lot of New Hollywood movies were, on actual location. It was shot on the streets of New York City. And Michael Moriarty, right at the center, just gives this performance that is so fucking strange. I would say it's cagey, Nicolas Cagey. Moriarty gives the impression that he is giving an improvised performance, which is like really bizarre for a special effects heavy monster movie. I wouldn't necessarily call it a great performance because he's actually really annoying. But my God, is it unusual? It is so unusual. And it really typifies like what this movie is about. Like you said, it's the stuff they usually leave out of a lot of monster movies. It's the performances and the tone and the heavy dialogue scenes that they usually are going to leave out of the movie.
It's also what's left out is there's so much exposition for a movie that's really straightforward. Monster attacks New York while cops and crooks play cops and crooks.
Right.
That's it. They don't go much beyond that.
No.
Except for every third scene or so, someone walks in and exposits some things that happened off scene. Like, yes. We'll make time jumps.
I know.
Like, whole trials have happened.
There's, like, real, like, shock edits, you know?
Yes.
Like, and it's cool because it's very unexpected. You know, it doesn't all work at all. A lot of it does not work at all.
I would disagree with you, though, that I thought Moriarty did give a great performance in that, I mean, he was captivating to me the whole time. And I guarantee you that a lot of those scenes were improvised, but he is such an anti-hero. Nobody on screen and nobody watching the screen can like this man.
No, everyone hates this guy. And while the creature effects are not necessarily great, they're pretty old-fashioned. I did think that it was cool that Larry Cohen does like film the attacks differently every time. He doesn't just find one way to shoot the monster. Like if we think back to like Megaforce, for example, there was a movie there. It was like, here's the one way we're going to shoot this, and we're going to shoot it like 300 times and then just edit it all together to do the same thing. This movie finds a different note for every one of the monster attacks. And there's a lot. There's like 10 or 12 or so. And it also has this really cool like vein of just dark, weird humor about it, too. It's especially, I think, in the opening and the closing scenes. It does drag in the middle.
The other thing I thought was really notable was the music is great throughout.
Yes, absolutely.
Scene appropriate. Building tension, ratcheting up music throughout this movie.
Absolutely. So yeah, let's get into it because the music starts right away. We get the old-fashioned kind of theremin scary music that we would get from like a 40s or 50s sort of a monster movie. So,
without an image on the screen,
no,
you
right.
know this movie is spooky.
And spooky in an old-fashioned sort of
yes.
way. Not spooky in a Blumhouse blow your fucking eardrums out kind of a way, but spooky in a like spooky music. It's a fucking plastic spider kind of a spooky, but you know what
exactly.
I mean? Like it's more charming to me.
It's haunted house spooky.
Absolutely. Our first victim coming right up onto the platter right away. So we're at the Empire State Building because again, this movie is, it's all about Manhattan in
it's
this movie.
All NYC.
Yeah. So we get a window washer. Who is like...
He's really up there with like a seatbelt really and rubber bands holding him in.
It's amazing how much like real actors are like in situations where you're kind of like, that looks like you were risking your life. Like being up there. That's a little intense. But yeah, this window washer, and he's also kind of a lech because he's not exactly spying, but he's just watching this blonde woman who is trying to work, and she's very annoyed, and she's like, this guy's back again, and he's always looking at me, and she smiles at him, but she's like, this guy's really awful. And then all of a sudden, crunch, boom, head off. We hear like a Gonzo. Big screech, and he screams, and his head is gone. And so on to the scene.
She's talking on her phone to her friend, and she's like, I wish he'd take a walk. And as soon as she says that, this guy's decapitated. And I'm like, yes, this is speaking your truth into existence. This is manifesting your reality with positive reinforcement.
I love the first like 10 or 15 minutes of this movie. It is so fast-paced. It is so fun. I was really, really loving this.
And I miss New York City of like the 70s and 80s.
The real
like,
New York, yeah.
Garbage in the streets.
Absolutely.
Hundreds of extras and onlookers just watching the shit get filmed.
There's no tourists anywhere. Yeah, so we meet the cops who are going to investigate this crime and every other crime in the city. These are the two detectives in New York. It's 1982. The budget's a little low. We got two detectives. They're handling every single case. And it's David Carradine, Sweetie, and Richard
Sweeney.
Oh, I thought we had it that time. Richard Roundtree, and they're investigating this headless man. And again, it's shot on New York. It is not Backdraft 2. Shot in New York or shot in Chicago in Toronto. You know what I mean?
Right, like exactly. This is no, we are on
it
the
is
streets.
New York. You are at the base of the Empire State Building. You're right there.
You may be in Chinatown than the Diamond District in one scene. You know, I mean, but it's still all New York.
It's all New York.
But what's great in this is this movie does not bullshit with anything. Like there is no bullshit. Richard Roundtree is looking for that head that got bit off the window washer. Carradine walks up, and the first spoken moment between these two is priceless. It is Carradine walks up and just goes, huh? And that's it. That's his greeting. That's his hello. That's his character introduction. He goes, huh? And Richard Roundtree tells him he's looking for a head. And that is fucking beautiful.
Cut to the chase, huh? So we do cut after their little short conversation where they can't find the head of this headless man. We do cut to a Chinese restaurant, and it's this great close-up of someone very slowly slicing a roasted duck with a cleaver.
Yeah.
Just love the fast pace and the fast cuts of these early scenes. So,
and some of the foley in throughout this movie is great. That, I mean, hearing the knife slice through the duck. Later on, they go to the Chrysler Building, and they like the revolving door plays very loud.
So we meet small-time crook Jimmy Quinn. This is Michael Moriarty, and he is planning a job with some wise guys. We definitely get the impression that Jimmy, he's a dirtbag, no doubt about it, but he's also a little bit out of his element here. Like these are real wise guys, and Jimmy is just a dirtbag ex-junkie.
He's a driver. He won't handle a gun.
Not going to handle
a wheel man. He'll get talked out of the percent that he thinks he's owed.
Right, exactly.
And he's sitting at a round table of New York character actors.
Absolutely. So from this scene, shot cut to whammo, another dead body, but this time it is a flayed body. A body has had its skin removed. And as they're discussing it, we like cut to the body having its latex, you know, skin cut off, this person having his face cut off. So it's in a hotel room, and it's just this body that is laying in bed completely devoid of skin. And David Carradine, I believe, is investigating this one too, and he says that he's also investigating a head that floated away like a balloon, at which point we get this great cut to a balloon that is just floating over like Central Park. And we should say the monster, while the monster is really not that impressive, I was super impressed with all of the fantastic helicopter shots of New York City, which is like the monster's eye view of like floating over the city and looking around. And there's these great zooms and things like that. And it really looks fantastic. And like most of monster movies, they're doing a thing where they're revealing the monster bit by bit. You know what I mean? You see a chomp coming at you. You see a claw. You see a little thing. You don't see the whole monster for a while.
You're set into a world where you don't know what's going on exactly.
Yeah. Our next victim coming right up. Stay off the damn roof, people. Right? That's like the only way he can get you is if you're on the roof. This
it
woman comes out.
It doesn't need to be booby time on the roof.
No, yeah, it does. So a woman comes out, takes her top off, because I don't know, they knew I was going to watch this movie someday. There's another lech spying on her with like binoculars, and then another kind of stop motion creature chomp that kind of comes in and takes her away while this guy sees it. That leads to another fantastic shortcut to this logo for a chicken restaurant of this like chicken man who is just kind of coolly sitting there as this bird is flying around killing people. And then there's this amazing sequence where blood is like raining on random New Yorkers. People are just walking in a crosswalk, going, oh, blood, what's all this blood?
It's okay, New York, chill out. A dragon gets its period above you. Be cool, man, okay?
Act like
offer
you've been
it
there.
A pad.
Come
yeah,
on.
You know?
You're acting like a tourist.
Don't make it a deal.
It is never really explained why nobody can see the gigantic feathered flying serpent that is flying above raining blood down on them.
Yeah, this movie doesn't
deal with
the
details
very well.
People just forget to look up, I think, because like, it's never explained, like, what, how the fuck?
Later on, we know the city's in panic just because one guy mentions that. It's like, we've not seen that. It's just one guy mentions, well, the city's in panic. Oh, okay, that's why class is going on behind you.
Yeah, right, exactly. No one is panicking at all. So Jimmy, he's got his heist job set up, but he also mentioned that he had another job, a real job that he might be able to, and then he wouldn't have to do the heist. Wouldn't that be great? So he goes into this bar. He kind of like nods to the barmaid. So yeah. We kind of gather that they know each other, and he says he knows about a job playing piano. They're like, how'd you know that? Obviously, it was the girl. So he sits down at the piano. And oh my god, I mean, he's a competent enough piano player, right? Jazz piano. I'm not a jazz piano fan, but whatever. What the fuck is he doing? I mean, like, scat singing is always bad. It's always bad.
Yeah,
doing intentionally bad scat singing is even worse. I don't even know what the fuck he's doing.
I think he literally put marbles in his mouth before he went in there to start singing. Because he just kind of starts going...
He just starts improvising scat singing for his audition. Like, fucking, what the fuck? Just play an old standard, for the love of God. Don't come in and scat sing. But that's how horrible this Jimmy is. Jimmy just...
Yeah, he doesn't really want the job. The bar owner tells him that he does not get the job with the power of boogie funk rock. He puts on the jukebox and plays a song over him.
That's your signal to stop. And David Carradine is in the bar with
him. Yeah, so the two detectives in New York City, one of them just happens to walk into the same bar that while Quinn's applying for a job. So earlier when we saw Carradine in Roundtree, I said, wow, Carradine's sober in this. This is
right.
The first Carradine I've seen where he's actually sober. This scene is the Carradine I'm familiar with.
It's like, okay, good.
Ordering a drink and not caring about the dialogue.
So now we go right to the heist job. So this music bit didn't work out. So now we go to the heist job. And of course, Jimmy.
Movie's clipping along.
It
clipping
really
along.
Is moving fast. Jimmy, of course, as we were talking about earlier, he's a weak, obviously. So he's going to get forced to take a gun. You're not going to wait in the car. Come on inside with us. So they go inside. We don't actually see what happens in there. We just hear some bangs. And out comes Jimmy. He's the only person to come out of the store. He's got a briefcase in hand. He starts running off. He's panicking. Alarms are going off.
He's Mr. Blonde. Or
he's
Mr. Blue.
He's Mr. Pink, absolutely. Except Mr. Pink runs right into a cab, which causes him to throw the briefcase. Like, honestly, like, if you were a discus thrower, you could not have thrown this thing this far. Like, he throws it several hundred feet, and it's lost forever. Like, that's just it. It's gone. Bye. He gets hit by a cab, and it just, he throws it like crazy. He can't find it, so he's like, oh, shit, what do I do? Still, you know, alarms and everything. So he's stumbling through Chinatown. He finds a phone booth and calls a friend and says, meet me, you know, at your office. And so he goes to the Chrysler building, walks up the Chrysler building, or takes the elevator up to the Chrysler building to his office, starts pounding on this guy's door, and it's obvious that this guy has just decided to leave him to the wind.
Right.
So an alarm sounds. Jimmy runs again. Now he's climbing into the tower of the Chrysler building. And we're going to spend a lot of time in this tower.
This guy's been hit by a fucking car, right?
Absolutely.
I thought it was restraint that they didn't have him fly up onto the hood like they usually do when someone's hit by a car. But he ran from Chinatown in lower Manhattan up to the Chrysler building.
And all the way up to the top of the building. Then starts climbing up to the, like, into the spire of the Chrysler building.
I mean,
building.
He's run 40 blocks in gridlock traffic with cops everywhere.
Absolutely.
After being hit by a car.
There's a guard that chases him for a little while, but he gives up. And so Jimmy just keeps climbing and climbing and climbing up to the top of the spire. And, like, it's... He's really fucking up there. Like, he is.
Yeah.
Up
oh,
there.
No. It's. Because
there's
up
some
there.
Shots where they kind of. This movie is not good enough to have special effects that could mimic, like, green nope. screen effects that could show that they are really way the fuck up there.
It really feels like Moriarty used that to channel into his unhinged.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Because the thing about Moriarty is he looks like he's an insurance salesman, but he's got this, like, crazy eye.
Yes.
And you know he's not playing with everything up there.
Absolutely. And his character is supposed to be an ex-junkie as well, as mm-hmm. we find out later. So he's
low self-esteem.
Yeah, self-destructive, mm-hmm. a little on the sociopathic side, doesn't really give a shit about anyone. You know, it's again, this is not your typical hero. This
no.
is,
this guy is hell's kitchen trash.
Absolutely. So he climbs to the top. He finds a giant nest up at the very top with an enormous egg in it. He finds some human remains. There's a bracelet on the human remains. That'll come back later. And then he hears the creature return. When he doesn't see it, but he's like, holy shit, something's happening. So he takes off.
But this is where I first noticed. I was like, this is nice talk. Tense action happening.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I was like, I'm into this.
Absolutely. So next victims. We're on the roof again. Construction workers. They're the real vulnerable ones here. They're always on the roof. So they're up there. There's a guy who's complaining about his stolen lunch, and he's looking around for his stolen lunch, and he gets his head chomped off. Somehow it got his head without getting his helmet, which is some real precision chomping. I mean, that is, for an Aztec god who has not been around for tens of thousands of years, that's pretty good. That's
what you didn't see good. Was the dragon chomping his head and then kind of picking its tooth, and out flies the helmet.
Right. Or he just farts it out like the dragon in
Doolittle. Yeah, in Doolittle.
Doolittle gets in there with a leak.
Best stunt in this whole movie, though, is this construction worker running down a ladder. I've never seen anybody do this. For some reason, David Carradine is all of a sudden at a museum, some museum somewhere, for some reason.
Looking at Aztec artifacts, he meets crazy museum guy who is talking about human sacrifice. And he's the expert on this kind of Aztec culture. Willing human sacrifice, and a high priest who would flay the skin and wear the skin, and they would do it all for Quetzalcoatl, who is the feathered flying serpent worshipped as a god.
They're going to get some more usage out of that flayed skin footage, because they are not going to get cheated on that. They cut back to that like three more times.
Now, Carradine now goes back and is reading about this stuff in bed with his girlfriend, which this scene has absolutely no reason to even be in the movie, except for that David Carradine walks away and says, before he's going to initiate sex, says, I better take my birth control pill. And then walks to the bathroom and runs back and does a fake scare out. Fake out.
All right,
scare
so thing. That is actually Derek Carradine's then wife.
Oh, is it really?
So I know that for a fact. I'm only 99.9% sure that is actually David Carradine's bedroom and bathrobe that he's wearing. And that somewhere exists 19 minutes of Carradine sex, because they start to make love and this movie cuts away from it.
Cut. Do not.
You know, he pointed at Larry Cohen and was like,
you keep those cameras rolling.
You film this. This is the reason I did this movie, Larry.
So Jimmy now returns home from his adventures at the Chrysler building, and he meets his girlfriend, which is the woman in the bar earlier, and they have a fight. Jimmy is like a little, again, he's very cagey here. He's just so odd. And he is having a little bit of a breakdown and stuff. He has this great throwaway line where he starts crying and he's like, I haven't cried since I was a kid. And it's just this, it's like, no one scripted that. You know what I mean? Like, obviously, he just came up with that. It's just like, not what you expect in an Aztec flying serpent monster movie.
He's true anti-hero. I mean, not only is he verbally abusive, he's physically abusive to her, because she's like grateful that he's not hitting her anymore. He hasn't hit her in a while. That seems like a victory in their relationship.
Right. She calls him a dumb ex-junkie.
begging for a drink, having a meltdown about toxic masculinity and fragility. And that's when he freaks out about the, when he says, bad dream, go away. Evil dream.
Yeah, this is, I mean, it's a really good scene.
It is.
Just because, like, you don't expect it, especially at this part of the movie, right? Like, in most movies, they would be done with the character setup at this point. They're done with it, right? We're moving on to resolving that.
And it doesn't stop with them. I mean, it doesn't stop with him.
No.
Every scene, you learn a little bit more about him, and especially comes back later when he's meeting with the, for some reason, meeting with the commissioner. But it really comes out then. Anyway. His girlfriend's dressed like G.I. Jane in the scene. She's got like these fatigue-looking greens on.
So we get another human sacrifice. Obviously another willing sacrifice because the guy's just kind of sitting there. We see an altar, giant tribal mask. We see somebody cutting into a body. And then, one of the things we love about this movie, it cuts right from like, okay, somebody in a mask cutting into him to... cops are investigating a body with a heart cutout that washed up on the beach, right? There isn't wasted time between any of those two things. It's real cause and effect right there as it's happening. So naturally, they call. Who do they call to the scene, though, Corky? The two detectives in New York. Fucking Garrity and Rowntree again.
Well, here's the thing, Dan. At this point, tell me what their names are.
I fucking... Shaft and Sweeney. That's all I got for you, man.
Sweeney.
Sweetie,
you do not learn their names until like minute 50 in the movie.
So back at Jimmy's apartment, the goons show up because remember, Jimmy supposedly has this. They don't know that he got hit by a taxi and threw it like an Olympus discus thrower. They think he still got the money. So the goons show up at his apartment. He climbs out his window. They chase him. And while they are chasing him, we hear what I assume is a Jimmy Scat song playing on the soundtrack.
Oh yeah, this was the weirdest
song. This is the weirdest
song.
Scene in the movie. This is the weirdest scene in a movie about a fucking Aztec serpent that comes to New York City. This is so strange. This song just like and what he's singing about is what is happening in the scene. Cause he's like, you're gonna chase me, I'm gonna run down the streets. You can't catch me. Here I go around the corner. Like, it's like, that's what he's singing about. I couldn't fucking believe it. Like,
I'm gonna get my gun. I'm gonna shoot you to pieces, throw you into the sun. What? Ow. What the fuck?
Yeah. That, you would not expect just like the music that plays during a random chase scene to be the strangest part of this movie, but by golly, it is.
When those bad guys come to get him, I know I'm backtracking a bit, but when those bad guys come to get him, he's locked into his apartment. Their news anchor's going on and on about this bird ravaging the city. They're clambering outside for him to come. They're banging on the door. There's a dog barking, music swelling, and there's buzzing. They repeated buzzing of the doors. It's like tension is. It was like the Boogie Nights robbery scene. Just everything's built. I almost wanted to see a little Asian man letting firecrackers.
Sir Jesse's girl. Scooby bop boop bop Jesse's girl. Yeah.
Sister Christian.
So the goons finally catch up with Jimmy. They defeat his scat song.
That's right. They fought the power of the scat.
Beat him up a little bit. He realizes, okay, I mean, these guys aren't going to believe that I threw a fucking briefcase into traffic. So I'll take you to where I hit it. So where does he take him? Of course, he takes him to the Chrysler building. Leads him right up to the elevator, climbing up the ladder, up to the nest, up. One by one, the first goon goes up. Chomp.
This is hilarious.
Second guy's like, hey, what are you doing up there? You better not be trying to take the money. And he goes up too. Like, what? You really leapt? You took a huge leap there because like we heard a giant monster and then the chomp. But okay. So he goes up and he gets chomped. And meanwhile, Moriarty comes down the ladder and just yells up there, eat him! Eat him! Eat him! And he just starts giggling and like crazy mumbling and stuff. He's super cagey in this scene.
He's just going off. This is where I was like, okay, this guy's too timid to pull a gun, too timid to like when they knock out the security guard, he's like, no, leave him be, he's okay. And now he's just like willfully feeding these guys like, to whatever's up there, up,
chomp him down.
But you see Moriarty go through this whole thing, rationalizing his behavior, freaking out.
Yeah. It's awesome. Another rooftop murder. More murders.
I thought it was pretty funny. One of the bad guys says to him, while they're climbing up to the top of the Chrysler building, "We would have never found this if it wasn't for you," in the most unnecessary line of dialogue.
Right. Oh, it was a great place to hide stuff, is it? Because he had to go past the security guard to get it. Yeah, sure, this is a good spot. Any other spot. I'm going to go bus station locker. How about that? No. Right? Spire of the Chrysler building in the dust.
Hole in the ground. How about that? Buried in a hole in the ground, not the top of the Chrysler building.
Pine Barrens. Just head right out to the Pine Barrens.
Sure.
So another rooftop murder happens. This time, this is one of my favorite ones, actually, is like this guy is up on the roof and he's just counting out like,
what the fuck is this?
32, 33, I'm so bored. 34, 35, and we see it's just this woman doing push-ups. He's up there with like four women in bikinis. One of them is doing push-ups, and he is so hilariously annoyed by the situation that he is in. He's like, forget it. He jumps into the pool because he's so bored, and all of a sudden a giant claw with talons comes down, plucks him right out of the water. And this, for the first time, instead of it being a stop-motion effect, it's an actual, like, actual claw, like a prosthetic or whatever you want to call it.
Something came from above claw, camera.
Something has picked him up and is actually in the claw there. And we get kind of a fuller view of the monster this time, too. But I love this one. It was just so...
Everybody except for him is so enthralled by this model doing push-ups in a bikini. And it's just other women in bikinis.
It's
and they're just
in
like,
bikinis. He's like,
giddy.
What am I doing up here? This is ridiculous.
How many push-ups can a model do coming to CBS this fall?
So Jimmy now gets arrested, and he is brought before Richard Roundtree, who slaps him around a little bit. Anyway, David Carradine, of course, is there too, because there's only two cops. There's more than two cops. There's only two detectives. It's only two homicide detectives.
But then there's someone else who's like, he's got white hair, so I'm assuming he's their boss.
Yeah, he's whatever's between the detective and a commissioner, sergeant. So yeah, David Carradine hears of the latest attack, and he says, that son of a bitch is getting bold. And so Jimmy overhears as the cops talk about Quetzalcoatl, but he doesn't share what he knows.
So this was my first like kind of disappointment. Like, this scene should have been good. The first time all our main characters
are together, yeah.
And it should be like Jimmy's playing a game where he doesn't want the security guard to see him, but he's also trying to eavesdrop on the cops. They walk in and out of this room like four times.
The blocking spatial location
is so weird.
Yeah, because they're like, oh, he's listening. Let's walk 3 feet in this direction.
And it could have been great.
Yeah, I made the same note. I was like, wow, this scene. And it goes on so long. It's slow. It's sluggish. And this starts like a real slow and sluggish part of the movie. As we were saying, like, I was having so much fun with the early part of the movie. And even after it kind of slows down a little, I was still really engaged in the story of Jimmy and this bizarre bird and these crazy attacks and all this kind of stuff. Ooh. This is rough. This starts kind of a rough part of the movie. But basically what happens is Jimmy just overhears about, you know, the cops are after this feathered flying serpent. He doesn't share what he knows, and he gets sent to prison instead. His girlfriend comes and visits him in prison.
This is also where we discover that Carradine's written a bird report. There's a blue-foldered bird report. Everybody touches this bird report for a bit.
This bird report is hot stuff.
Nobody reads his goddamn bird report.
He
worked
out. To read
this
his
report. Mom helped him the last night. Sure, he put it off.
Right? She built the model bird.
And he got knocked off 10 points because he didn't put a bibliography.
So Jimmy goes to prison. Girlfriend visits him in prison, and Jimmy shares with her his plan to use his knowledge of Q and its hiding place to get rich. This is really boring stuff. This whole like about 15-minute section of the movie. It's unfortunate because this could have just been a few minutes. It didn't really need to be this long.
But you talk about great helicopter shots of New York City. There's one right here where it actually kind of almost dives between the Twin Towers.
Oh, wow. What a shot. Fantastic shot. Yeah. Yeah. Great use of the helicopter and the camera kind of tilt. Swivels and zooms and stuff like that to give this like impression not just of like a panorama of New York City, but you're also kind of like trying to locate yourself in it while the camera's turning. And it's really well shot. So Jimmy now meets with all of the cops.
This is my favorite. This is so good.
And he lays out what he wants for sharing the location of Q. He wants a Nixon-like pardon and wants $1 million.
So I guess any low-life scumbag criminal can meet with the police commissioner if he just asks. If he just says, I want a meeting with the police commissioner. Yes. Gets a sit-down. Carradine and Roundtree are in this. This is where you find out their names are Shepard and Powell. Carradine is drawing a bird on a yellow piece of legal pad. And I swear to God, he was just doing that on set. Like, they didn't tell him to do that. He didn't know the camera was on. He's just drawing a fucking bird. But this is when you learn, this is when I was talking about earlier, like we talked about that scene with Jimmy and his girlfriend, where Moriarty is just so good. You learn that he's been set up in the past, and this is his get back with the city.
At
19, a cop planted coke on him, and he doesn't come out with it like it sounds like it's exposition. It sounds like it's an honest, this is my fucking...
It's a part of his character. It's part of who this guy is, and he says... Yeah, the other one, the second one, that was me. That was
that,
me.
You I got did
me
that.
On that one. That's fair and square. But you set me up for the very first ones. One of you crooked New York cops set me up on that first one. And this is my, I'm going to get even for that. Like, I've earned this one. I've earned this pardon. So they're going to drop the paperwork. So we have this really long scene. It's like Jarmusch-esque, this coffee scene with David Carradine and Jimmy. They just go down to a coffee shop and they're just like, let's share stories. So Jimmy, David Carradine mentions that he met him in the bar that one time. And Jimmy tells about how there was a black cellmate of his. And it was this guy who killed a whole bunch of white people. But he told him he's going to teach this white boy how to play piano. And this is how he did it. And he learned how to play piano. And then right in the middle of this scene, all of a sudden, there's like this media ambush. Like the media just like a couple came like, did you know about this bird? How do you know about this? Get the hell out of here. Blah, 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 blah. That goes on for like a minute. And then it's just right back to it. This is right back to their conversation. It, like I said, it's like Jarmusch-esque. You know,
this scene is supposed to be. It's supposed to be Carradine is pumping Jimmy for the location without Jimmy actually realizing he's giving it. If it was in the hands of a more skilled director, he's competent. Larry Cohen's competent, but in a more skilled director. Or I think if Carradine could give a little more, it would have been effective in this. Because Roundtree is the second interruption.
That cat and mouse thing that's going on there. Yeah, I absolutely get what you're saying.
You would think that Carradine's a better detective than you actually think he is.
But it also just gives an idea of just the really unusual rhythm and kind of pacing of this movie, that it would have this really long dialogue scene just to kind of get more character information.
It's almost as if this movie was benefited by its lack of money. Like, they didn't have the money for the monster shots or locations. They invaded a coffee shop for a day and shot there.
So they go back. Everything's ready to sign the papers. The commissioner gives the bird report back to David Carradine.
Yeah.
And he's basically like, keep the cases separate. Keep this bird thing separate from this ritual killing thing. We're basically, there's a cover up and it's
so underway. But the mayor also kind of says, I don't believe it. This is all bullshit. I don't believe it.
But he's also like, I've never read it. I've never read this thing. And he obviously has. So it's about like plausible liability. He's saying like,
gotcha.
I don't want people coming back later to be like, you approved killing a giant bird and thought it was part of an Aztec ritual or something like that.
I gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
It's politics.
It's politics. Chinatown. It's a cover up. Absolutely.
It's Chinatown, then the Diamond District.
So the cops now race into the Chrysler Building. Because now they're going to kill the thing. They know where it is. Jimmy's given up the location. He's got his money. Jimmy leads them right up to the nest. We get kind of a repeat of what happened at the bank job where Jimmy's kind of forced to participate. He wants to hang back on the margins. And they also give him a firearm, too.
I love Moriarty just giddily getting the SWAT team onto the elevator, joining them. He's with the team. He's a big man. Oh, he's asking about this big canvas that he thought should be laid over the city, over the building. And he's like, disappointed it's not there. I fucking love the little touches like that.
It really is. Yeah, he has some idea that they're going to put a circus tent over the whole. I feel like it's still not, like it never makes sense. I was like,
but his dumbass idea, he thought it was good.
He's so proud of his idea.
circumstance. Don't blame me.
So David Carradine gets up to the top. There's no Quetzalcoatl, but there is the nest, and there is the egg, and you've got a machine gun. What are you going to do?
Bish, 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 bish. Oh, shit. It's starting to hatch.
Everyone starts shooting it. They kill it. Fake out! And then they kill it. This is like a big fake out death movie.
Oh, yeah. When Carradine's climbing up there to face it with the machine gun, there's an 80-yard line because Carradine makes a joke about omelets because of the big-ass egg. And you hear an 80-yard line said, Shepard only makes jokes when he's scared of something.
Yeah, right. It's like,
thanks. We're supposed to be scared now. Okay,
he's scared,
great.
Everybody.
The hero's scared.
So they go down again. They've killed the egg, but the Q is nowhere to be seen. And David Carradine is now like kind of mocking Jimmy a little bit, saying that because they didn't get Q, he's going to lose the money. He's going to lose the immunity. He makes bird noises at him to mock him.
Oh. Quinn tells him, stick it up your brain, your small little brain.
Quick cut. The movie suddenly is now coming back to life again, right?
This is when, you want to talk about a movie that ends strong.
Quick cut to a mime. What is this, Father's Day and an alternative rock concert? No.
It's not a mime, Dan. It's an undercover mime.
He's
coming
an
this
undercover
fall to CBS.
Mime staking out the American Museum of Natural History, of course. So he puts in a phone call like, they're on the move. So they follow Crazy Museum Guy. Remember Crazy Museum Guy from earlier who told us all about Quetzalcoatl? So they follow him into the Liberty Warehouse, which is this place in New York that I guess is real or was real. I don't know. Does it still exist? But at the top of the building, like, you see the Statue of Liberty. So you're like, huh, what the fuck? And even in the film, the character is like, huh, what the fuck? Explain. And somebody actually explains. It's the model of the Statue of Liberty that they used to build the thing. Liberty Warehouse bought it and put it on top of their building. So it's this gigantic warehouse where all of the Aztec stuff is at. And it has a giant statue of a giant small version of the Statue of Liberty right on the roof. It's really strange. Sort of a scene. Anyway, so the cops all go in here. There's all this Aztec stuff everywhere. They go in, the high priest is there. He's got his mask on. The crazy museum guy is ready to be sacrificed. The cops corner and shoot him mid-sacrifice and chase the priest into the statue. So that's where they
there's a cop him. That goes, it's coming for me. It's coming for me. In that line reading. Not an actor, I'm assuming.
Well, he says, no, he says, because the museum guy, as he's being like cut open and sees the cops, leaps up and starts running at them like, you guys get out of here. Leave us alone for our Aztec sacrifice. And the guy just like, bah, 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 like puts several rounds into him. And then he has this look at the camera where he's kind of like a little shell shocked and is sort of like, he was coming right at me. He was coming right at me. It's like he's already making up his excuse for unmotivated cop killing. Anyway. So yeah, they chase the high priest. Richard Roundtree chases the high priest up into this statue, this small version of the Statue of Liberty that's on top of the roof. They go out onto the roof.
Him and the mime.
Fucking mistake. Do not go on the roof.
If you ever see a mime with a gun, fucking run.
It's setting. Q swoops down, grabs Richard Roundtree in his talons. And just drops him to the ground from like hundreds of feet off. We don't see him splat, but obviously.
But what's great is you only get the mime's reaction to it.
Yes.
And you're like, well, so did it really happen? Or is he just trapped in a box? Like, what's
has fake binoculars looking at him. Oh, my.
He tries to run away against the wind.
Now Jimmy is back at the apartment screaming at his girlfriend, and she's basically like, you're done. We're done for good. Don't
give
a shit.
She exposits that there's already been a trial about Doyle and Webb, the two men he led up to the
How
fucking...
is that possible?
In court, they said you killed them, and now they're after you.
The legal system just moves like a hot knife through butter, doesn't it? So we go back to the Chrysler Building, and now all the cops are waiting there for Q. And sure enough, Q shows up, and they quote-unquote let her have it.
The cops went to the Chrysler Building.
Yeah.
We also got the subplot of Richard Roundtree and the mime. Night happened. We saw night descend. Those SWAT guys and David Carradine have been up there for over 48
just
hours.
Hanging out.
Just hanging out up in the Chrysler Building.
Yeah, why not?
Eating egg.
having some egg. So Q finally approaches the Chrysler building, and they basically fire at her from every corner of the building. Like, you just see all these like shots coming off of the Chrysler building. People are on window washer platforms. People are on every window and corner and every possible hole they can find in the spire.
And they're really up there like the window washer was. These are guys really up in baskets. Absolutely. Up on the top of this building.
And yeah, Q even knocks one of these guys on the window washer platform right off of the building.
The effects are Land of the Lost.
They're not great, but it's fun. It's fun.
It's fun. Exactly. I did not care that they weren't. It added to my enjoyment.
It was creative the way they were able to shoot it.
Exactly.
With the Monster's Eye view and the...
There's also a great part right here where Mime Cop is out of makeup now. He's in his uniform. And he doesn't really want to be there. Like, he's timid. Yeah. And Q's like, or Shepard's like, come, that's Carradine. Come on, you can do this. Pushes him up the ladder. And he's the next fucking one eaten and thrown out.
Q, like, lands on the building, finally. Grabs him in its maw and just flings this, like, rookie cop all
the way down the building. That is directly Shepard's fault.
Oh, absolutely. And there's even, like, another death fake out, which, oh, we got him. Q, he's bloodied. But then all of a sudden, and he almost kills Shepard again. But
There's a cut to the pandemonium down below. There's a cut to the pandemonium, people running. There's like three extras who roll in the street. For no reason, they just drop and start rolling, like stop, drop, and roll. Like the director was like, all right, somebody roll, somebody fall. Okay, you're freaking out. They do it sequentially. It's glorious.
Luckily, they find the one weakness of this mythological feathered flying serpent god.
Blondes.
And that is machine guns.
Oh, damn it.
Machine guns. It's one weakness. Bullets.
Who would have thunk?
So it is riddled with bullets, covered in blood, and crashes on this roof, this like pyramid-like roof.
Yeah.
And kind of tries to scramble up there and then finally falls to the earth. But before it lands, we get another smash cut to Jimmy reading about it in the paper and kind of laughs and looks out his window and says, I saved you all. And he gets a knock at the door, though. What the fuck? Who the fuck's at his door? Oh, my God. It's the high priest. It's the high priest who got away from Richard Roundtree on the rooftop. He says, it's meant that we should meet. So he's ready to sacrifice Jimmy.
The plume serpent will rise again, which is my line in the bedroom. Give me 20 minutes, babe. The plume serpent will rise again.
The cops show up at this Fleabag hotel where Jimmy is saying... The priest is about to sacrifice him. He's trying to say, like, you need to say this prayer. You need to say this or that. And Jimmy is like, piss on your prayer. The priest didn't get me to say a prayer. I never said the prayer for the priest. I'm not going to say a prayer for you.
and the guy's like, no, come on. You really got to say it so I can slit your throat. You really got to do it. No. Piss on your fucking prayer.
Piss on your prayer. David Carradine, don't worry, he jumps in and shoots the priest, boosh, 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 and laughs because he had a rusty knife to his neck. I hope you've had your tetanus shots.
Dan, you delivered that with so much more aplomb than Carradine did.
But oh no, death fake out, boosh, boosh, another death fake out, boosh, another, boosh, boosh, boosh. And Carradine says, with even more aplomb, this guy does not die easily.
There's also a fucking fantastic moment in here where Carradine accidentally knocks a pillow onto him and then smacks the pillow off disgustedly. It's so... I was loving the end of this movie.
So good. So they're in the hallway of this hotel room now. And
Before the hallway, there's another one of these expository voiceovers where Carradine's face is turned and the voiceover says... I figured this guy would try to come watch you, so I staged you out. It's like somebody was like, wait, why is he there? How did this happen?
Yeah, they're like, we went to every Fleabag hotel in town. Yeah. But when they get out of the car, they are very determined. Because I mean, if they were like, wait a minute, this is the last one. It has to be this one. Rush up the stairs.
break it down. He's like, check every hotel on 8th Avenue. So they ran into every room in every hotel on 8th Avenue with that gun drawn, ready to blast.
They saw things so much more disturbing than what was happening in Jimmy's hotel room with the fucking high priest about to even sacrifice him.
You know they saw
shit so much more worse.
They saw some plume serpents rising.
Yeah, absolutely. So they're in the hallway now, and it's sort of the postmortem. What are you going to do? Jimmy says he's going to go get a job.
It's like a fucking buddy show. They're
it's
just
so
like
weird.
Two
he's
pals kibitzing.
Like, I know I'm not afraid anymore. That's like his thing, is that he said early on when he's climbing up into the Chrysler building, I've been afraid of everything in my life, but I'm not afraid of heights. It's a weird thing, so I'm going to keep climbing. But he says I'm not afraid anymore. I don't know. Was that his journey? Maybe. What I know is that the bizarre flourish to the scene is that David Carradine makes a little remark to himself and then switches the Do Not Disturb signs on two different hotel rooms in there for no reason.
Oh, my God. They have a coda of the what the fuck do you know, except this time it's Carradine saying it to him. He's like, yeah, what the fuck do I know? So that's their little end of their thing. Carradine mutters to himself, good old-fashioned monster. Takes a Do Not Disturb sign off somebody's door. Someone's in there trying to have some privacy. Hangs it on the door of where there's a man he just shot down. He's a cop. He is a detective. And he's saying, hide this body. Let some maid find it. I'm going to deny any responsibility.
I'm done. I got to go take my birth control pill.
It is magic. I fucking loved it.
Really is. So then we get the coda of the film, which is yet another helicopter shot over Manhattan. It's kind of craning above. It comes down into a different building, which has sort of an exposed roof. We go in. And there, of course, in a giant nest, is a different giant egg. The end.
Amazing.
Yeah.
That castle at the end is at 105th and Central Park West, if you're curious. It's still there, by the way, because in the movie it's all busted out.
Yeah.
They rehabbed it.
Nice. Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's quite an aerial tour.
It is.
Of New York, of Lower Manhattan especially. But that is our film, Quirky. That is our film. It is Q-: The Winged Serpent. So just to remind everybody, run-of-the-mill bad film, a dare, truly atrocious movie, a double dare, and a movie that we actually like, a reverse dare. Quirky, what's your rating for Q, the Winged Serpent?
I'm going reverse dare on this. My girlfriend asked me when I was done, she goes, oh, so how terrible was your movie? I said, it was bad, but it was fucking good.
Yeah.
I've never had this experience on Dare Daniel or Scare Daniel, where the schlocky moments made it even better. Like it was schlock in such a good way. Like you said, it was creative schlock. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they didn't have the money to do the budget, but they made it interesting every step of the way. There's just enough dark humor. There's just enough weird what the fuck moments. There's good acting.
Yeah, yeah. Really unlike anything else that you would see in this genre, for sure.
I like that it was just streamlined, that there was no nonsense, no filler, mm-hmm. not a bunch of other shit. It bogs down in the middle for about 15, 20 minutes, but man, does it steamroll at the end. And I was just cracking up, laughing, and enthusiastic about all the horribleness and the good stuff all along.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I'm going to go reverse dare as well. I really liked Michael Moriarty's performance. I really like all the stuff that we were talking about. It's just such... It does get really sluggish in the middle there, which is too bad because it starts so great and it ends so great. It's a fascinating concept for a monster movie, because it really is shot in New York City. I mean, it is authentic New York City of the early 80s. And then just the fact that, in addition to Moriarty's performance, really just the concept of it. I mean, it's like having a monster movie where your hero is Ratso Rizzo.
Yeah,
he's street trash. Like this guy is he's not evil necessarily, but he is trash. He's not a good person. And so to have him as the hero of your movie, I think is really fascinating. And it kind of just speaks to how a little off center this movie is. They do not try to do it in the traditional way, and it's all the better for it. Again, it's not a masterpiece because it does get a little pokey there in the middle, but it is definitely worth a watch, and it's there for free on Amazon Prime and Tubi and other places, so check it out.
Thank you, Hall of Fame Head. Another just
another
plaque
win.
On your mantle. That is all we have for you on this episode of Scare Daniel. But we'll be back in 2 weeks to review another one of your movie dares.
Until then, send your most sadistic or altruistic movie dares to us at daredaniel.com and be sure to follow Dare Daniel on your Schmeed, that is your Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Like and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can read more of my movie reviews on the Dare Daniel website at daredaniel.com. Corky.
Yeah.
You are a washed up ex-junkie. You are living on the streets of New York. You are scat singing your own jazz piano creations. I mean, where can people find you just doing that voodoo that you do a show well?
You can usually just find me curled up on my girlfriend's couch complaining that she doesn't support me enough. Or being chased by thugs throughout New York City singing, I've got a gun. You're going to run, throw you into the sun. Booba scotty bopu.
Scoobity boop, boppy 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 bop. Bye, everyone.
Love you.